Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I was looking for fun ways to tell you that Mint's offer of unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month is back. So I thought it would be fun if we made $15 bills. But it turns out that's very illegal. So there goes my big idea for the commercial. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes of networks busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
What is dadication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariana. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dadication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. And before we dive into today's episode, I just want to thank those of you who have been using our website, mamamystery.com, to write in case recommendations, but also topics for our Mama Minute episodes. I really enjoy doing these Mama Minutes, and I feel like it's just a necessary break from the constant doom and gloom of true crime. Maybe not all of you can relate to this, but I sometimes feel a little burnt out on true crime, so I just feel like I need a brain break, and this is really what those episodes are for. So if you don't need them, you can skip them, of course, but if you are enjoying those episodes, be sure to let us know. And if there's ever a topic that you want us to cover or a recommendation for a true crime case, you can fill out the form on our website, mamamystery.com. Now let's get into today's case. Mark and Christine Lundy were living the dream. They were married for 17 years, raising their bright 7-year-old daughter, Amber, in the quiet town of Palmerston North, New Zealand. But in August of 2000, that peaceful life was shattered when a friend made a horrifying discovery. Christine and Amber were found brutally murdered in their own home. The scene was so violent that it stunned the entire community. What could have happened? Was this a random act of violence or something more calculated? The truth would turn this very small town upside down. But first, to understand what happened, we have to go back to August of 2000.
The Lundy family, Mark, Christine, and their 7-year-old daughter, Amber, lived in Palmerston North, New Zealand, and by all appearances, they were the epitome of a wholesome, tight-knit family. Palmerston North was perfect for them. Think small town vibes, a slow pace, a kid-friendly atmosphere that any parent would dream of. Mark was this big, tall guy with kind of thinning brown hair and those thick 90s style like Coke bottle glasses that were huge back then. And Christine, on the other hand, was shorter, a little curvier, and she had a bright, blunt, blonde bob. Say that 10 times fast. Bright, blunt, blonde bob with glasses to match. The Lundys had been married for 17 years, and by all accounts, their relationship seemed solid. They rarely fought and seemed to have a really strong bond, being each other's best friends. They also had a daughter named Amber, a bright, outgoing little girl who was adored by her teachers. She had rosy cheeks, a short little bob like her mom's, and a smile that would light up a room. But beneath this exterior, things were far from ideal, as they typically are. And Mark and Christine ran a kitchen sink business, but unfortunately, this business was not doing very well. Selling kitchen sinks isn't exactly a hot commodity, right? And they were over $100,000 in debt. And as the business floundered, the strain on their finances started to weigh heavily on the family. In an attempt to turn things around, Mark bought 2 plots of land in Hawke's Bay with the intention of growing grapes and then selling the grapes to wineries. He had high hopes that this vineyard would pull them out of their debt, but things just did not go as planned. Mark missed payments on the land, the late fees began piling up, and their financial situation spiraled even further out of control. So by 2000, things were looking pretty bleak. On August 29th, 2000, Mark left Palmerston North to head to another town for business. He was trying to revitalize the failing sink business, making sales pitches and meeting with clients. And meanwhile, Christine and Amber stayed home. Throughout the day, Mark called home several times, but no one picked up. And at first, he didn't think much of it. But when his calls went unanswered for hours, he grew increasingly worried. At 11:40 a.m., Mark asked his friend Stuart to check on Christine and Amber, and what was discovered next would shake not just Mark's world, but the entire community. When Mark's friend Stuart arrived at the Lundy family home around midday on August 30th, he expected to find Christine and Amber just going about their day, but what he walked into was a nightmare. The house was eerily quiet, and the sliding glass door at the back of the house was wide open, which was a detail that immediately set off alarm bells. Calling out for Christine and Amber yielded no response, so Stuart ventured further inside, eventually stumbling upon something horrifying in the hallway. Amber, this sweet 7-year-old, was lying motionless on the floor, still in her nightgown. The scene was brutal. Her face was so badly beaten that it was barely recognizable. She had been struck repeatedly in the head, and as Stuart's panic grew, he glanced towards the bedroom where he saw Christine's body on the bed, and she too had been violently attacked, with her head beaten so severely that blood and brain matter were smeared across the room. The brutality was barbaric and just unimaginable. Stuart immediately called for help, and the police arrived on the scene, confirming what everyone had feared. Both Christine and Amber were dead. The Lundy home was quickly cordoned off, and investigators began piecing together what had happened. Blood was splattered across the walls and ceiling, and fragments of Christine's skull were found scattered around the bedroom. But as disturbing as this scene was, something was even more puzzling. Nothing else in the house was disturbed. There was no sign of forced entry beyond a broken window latch, and only Christine's jewelry box was missing. So was this a robbery gone wrong? The evidence suggested otherwise. The viciousness of this attack pointed to something much more personal. Whoever had killed Christine and Amber hadn't just wanted to steal from them, they had a vendetta. So when Mark arrived home, his worst fears were realized. He had rushed back from his business trip only to be stopped by a police officer blocking his street. And in a state of confusion and fear, Mark was told that his wife and daughter were gone, that they were brutally murdered. According to those who saw him, Mark's reaction was visceral. He broke down in tears, he was shaking uncontrollably, and was just in a state of shock that the police didn't even allow him to drive himself to the station. Once at the station, the police began questioning him, and naturally the first thing they wanted to establish was Mark's alibi. Where had he been the night before? Mark explained that he had been in another town staying at a hotel while trying to make sales for his business. He even admitted to something that would soon become a huge part of the investigation, that he had hired a sex worker named Belinda that night, a practice that he claimed was not unusual for him. I'm sorry, but can we just pause for a moment at the fact that Belinda was a sex worker? Like, I don't know about the images that are popping up in your mind, but for me, a sex worker named Belinda, I just don't think of somebody whose name is Belinda as a sex worker. I guess that's all I'll say about that. But anyway, according to Mark, he spent the night of August 29th with Belinda from about 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. And then he went to bed and checked out of his hotel the next morning. Now, at first glance, Mark had a solid alibi. The sex worker confirmed his story and hotel records backed up his timeline. Mark insisted that he had no reason to harm his family, maintaining that his relationship with Christine was loving and stable, despite admitting that they had not been intimate in some time, but also despite admitting that he regularly hired sex workers. But the police, while initially seeming to accept Mark's version of events, still found certain aspects of his story odd. Why had he lied about his sex life with Christine? And why was his phone mysteriously inactive for a three-hour window on the night of the murders? These small inconsistencies began to paint a complicated picture. Now, in the days following the murders, rumors began swirling. Despite the police stating publicly that Mark was not a suspect, the whispers in the community were growing louder. Some people believed that Mark's emotional breakdown at the funeral, with his loud sobbing and his inability to even stand without help, which I have a picture of this. I'll put it on our Instagram if you want to see pictures associated with this case. But his behavior, the theatrics, it was just so over the top that it kind of seemed performative. Was this genuine grief, or was he trying to kind of cover something up? And it didn't help that video footage of Mark at the funeral was broadcast on the news, feeding the rumors even further. People began to question whether his grief was real or an act, especially given the increasingly suspicious details emerging about his personal life. Some speculated that Mark's financial struggles could have driven him to commit the murders, especially after it came to light that he and Christine had recently increased her life insurance policy to $500,000 just days before the murders. And I know you all are probably just like, this is a pretty cut and dry case. Like, obviously he has something to do with it. But even with the growing public suspicion, the police were reluctant to officially label Mark as a suspect because his alibi seemed solid and they had no direct evidence linking him to the crime, at least not yet. As the investigation continued, forensic experts began analyzing every piece of evidence that they could find, and one discovery would prove to be a turning point in the case. A shirt found in Mark's car, inside out and stuffed into a suitcase, was sent for DNA testing. The results were shocking. Tiny stains on the shirt contained Christine's DNA, and more disturbingly, forensic experts concluded that the stains weren't just from a casual contact or a hug, because that's kind of what I first thought was, well, of course her DNA is going to be on his stuff. They live together. They're married. But no, this DNA was specifically from brain tissue, and it was Christine's. That finding changed everything. How could Mark have Christine's brain matter on his shirt if he hadn't been at the scene of the crime? The brutality of Christine's murder meant that her brain tissue was literally smeared across the room. So for it to end up on Mark's shirt raised a serious question, which was, okay, could Mark be involved in this? Now, despite this damning piece of evidence, there were still some doubts. The stain on the t-shirt was minuscule, far smaller than anyone would expect if Mark had been directly involved in such a violent beating. So shouldn't he have been covered in blood and other evidence if he had been the killer? Some experts argued that the small size of the stains suggested that Mark might have been wearing some sort of protective clothing during the murders, like maybe coveralls or a jumpsuit. And that's where another piece of witness testimony came into play. One of the strangest details of the case came from a neighbor named Margaret Dance. Margaret claimed that on the night of August 29th, around 7:15 p.m., she saw a man running down the street near the Lundy house. He was heavyset, dressed in what looked like a jumpsuit, and oddly, he was wearing a blonde wig. As the man ran past her, Margaret realized that he seemed frightened and possibly even panicked. Margaret thought that the man resembled Mark, but she just couldn't be certain. Still, her account added a bizarre twist to the case, suggesting that Mark may have been disguising himself in order to carry out the murders without being recognized. But while this testimony was intriguing, it wasn't enough on its own to conclusively tie Mark to the crime. There were too many unanswered questions. How did he manage to drive between the two towns within that tight timeline? Why were there only two tiny stains on his shirt when the crime scene was so horrific? And if he had indeed disguised himself in a blonde wig and the jumpsuit, where are those items now? One of the biggest challenges in the case against Mark was the timeline. For the prosecution's theory to hold water, Mark would have had to drive from his hotel in Petone back to Palmerston North, murder Christine and Amber, his own daughter, stage the scene to look like a robbery, dispose of the murder weapon and any evidence like the jumpsuit and the wig, and then return to his hotel all in the space of only 3 hours. So I Googled the distance between Petone, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and Palmerston North, and the distance is about an hour and 45 minutes. So that alone just tells me that that wouldn't have fit within that 3 hour timeline. So to make this journey, Mark would have had to speed the entire way, navigating through rush hour traffic and still managing to complete all the necessary steps to commit the murders. So police actually conducted test drives to see if that trip was even possible, and they were only able to replicate the drive in about an hour and 33 minutes under ideal conditions. But even then, it was a stretch to believe that Mark could have pulled off this murder or these murders in such a short amount of time. Now, as the investigation delved deeper into Mark's personal life, a potential motive began to emerge. The Lundys were drowning in debt, and Mark's financial situation was growing increasingly desperate. His vineyard investment was failing, the kitchen sink business was floundering, and bills were piling up. Just a day before the murders, Mark received a notice about a missed payment on his land, threatening foreclosure if he didn't come up with the money soon.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max bundle. It's the ultimate bundle for an unbelievable price. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. Get it and watch Marvel Television's Ironheart on Disney Plus.
I want to build something iconic.
A new season of The Bear on Hulu.
We can make people happy.
And the epic, a Minecraft movie on Max.
Anything you can imagine is possible.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max bundle. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. All these and more now streaming. Terms apply. Visit DisneyPlusHuluMaxBundle.com for details.
When life brings the blah, add more Yabba Dabba Doo with some tasty Fruity Pebbles. Early morning meeting, blah. Someone brought the pebbles? Yabba Dabba Doo! Run errands? Blah. Head to the store for pebbles. Yabba Dabba Doo! Fruity Pebbles, less blah, more Yabba Dabba Doo. Pick up Pebbles cereal today. Yabba Dabba Doo and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn to earn, save, and spend wisely, and parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Try Greenlight risk-free today at greenlight.com/Spotify.
Then there was the life insurance policy. Mark and Christine had signed papers to increase her coverage just 5 days before the murders, boosting it from $200,000 to $500,000. The timing was obviously suspicious, to say the least. Was Mark planning to murder his wife for the payout, believing it would solve all of his financial problems? But still, there were complications. The life insurance policy would not have paid out immediately. It wasn't even fully processed at the time of Christine's death. So did Mark make a fatal mistake killing his family in hopes of a payout that he wouldn't even receive? As the investigation unfolded, the police became increasingly convinced that Mark Lundy was their prime suspect. Between the strange evidence on his shirt, the possible sighting of him running near the scene, and his complicated financial situation, they believed they had a case. But there were still gaps, particularly when it came to hard evidence tying Mark directly to the crime scene. Despite Mark's alibi, the timeline became a central focus. The police zeroed in on that three-hour window when Mark's phone had no activity, a gap that coincided with the estimated time of death for Christine and Amber. Forensics determined that the murders likely occurred between 7 p.m. and 7:15 p.m. based on stomach contents from their last meal. Earlier that day, Christine and Amber had eaten McDonald's around 5:45 p.m., and stomach acid levels suggested that they were killed about an hour later. Now, with this in mind, the police theorized that Mark had made an hour and a half drive from Patone back to Palmerston North during that window of inactivity. And this theory also explained the amount of gas Mark purchased on August 29th, just enough to make the trip to Palmerston North, return to Patone, and drive back the next day. But even with all this speculation, there were questions about whether the tight timeline could realistically fit the crime. Mark, of course, continued to deny any involvement, maintaining that his alibi was airtight. He pointed out that he was not only with a sex worker, Belinda, but also made several phone calls that evening, leaving little time to have driven back to commit the murders, and still police believed that they had enough circumstantial evidence to move forward. So in February of 2001, Mark Lundy was arrested for the murders of his wife and daughter. The arrest was met with shock by some who still believed he couldn't have been responsible for such a gruesome crime, but others felt that the mounting evidence painted a different picture. The prosecution's case hinged on several key points: the DNA evidence on Mark's shirt, the testimony of the neighbor who saw a man resembling Mark near the scene, and the financial motive that tied everything together. According to the prosecution, Mark had become desperate, facing financial ruin. He had taken out a larger life insurance policy on Christine and murdered her in hopes of collecting the payout, killing Amber only because she had witnessed the crime. During the trial, the prosecution painted a damning portrait of Mark as a man willing to do anything to escape his financial problems, even if it meant committing such an unspeakable act against his wife and child. They also presented evidence that Christine was found naked, which they argued was a part of a ruse to make the murder appear sexually motivated or part of a robbery gone wrong. However, the brutal nature of the attack suggested a much more personal motive. For his part, Mark took the stand and insisted that he loved his family and would never hurt them. He reiterated that his alibi placed him far away from the crime scene during the time of the murders. And he admitted to cheating on Christine with that sex worker, but claimed that it was unrelated to his family's deaths. Mark's defense team also pointed out that if he had committed such a violent act, there would have been far more blood and DNA evidence on him, not just the small stains on his shirt. But the jury found the DNA evidence compelling, and the forensic timeline supported the theory that the murders took place during the window of Mark's phone's inactivity. After 7 hours of deliberation, the jury found Mark Lundy guilty of the murders of Christine and Amber. He was sentenced to life in prison with a non-parole period of 17 years. However, the case was far from over. Almost immediately after Mark's conviction, his defense team began the appeals process, arguing that the evidence used to convict him was flawed. 4 months after the trial, their first appeal was denied, and Mark's non-parole period was actually increased from 17 to 20 years. But as time went on, questions surrounding the case began to mount, particularly regarding the forensic evidence. The small DNA stains on Mark's shirt had been a key piece of the prosecution's case, but some experts began to challenge the reliability of the methods used to test the stains. Specifically, the technique used to identify Christine's brain matter was called into question. The pathologist who conducted the test, Dr. Rodney Miller, had used a method known as immunohistochemistry, or IHC, which many in the forensic science community regarded as controversial and unreliable when used to detect brain tissue. The defense argued that the stains on Mark's shirt could have come from some other form of contact with Christine, like a hug or an accidental brushing against her. They also highlighted that the brain cells would have likely degraded long before the testing was ever done, casting further doubt on the validity of the evidence. Multiple other pathologists testified that there was no other clear way to determine if the stain was brain matter or not, raising serious concern about the cornerstone of the prosecution's case. These questions culminated in a 2009 article titled "The Lundy Murders: What the Jury Didn't Hear," which brought to light several issues that hadn't been fully explored during the trial. The article suggested that much of the forensic evidence was unreliable and raised concerns about the timeline of the murders, particularly the assumption that Christine and Amber were killed shortly after eating. The article also pointed out several pieces of evidence that hadn't been thoroughly examined during the initial investigation. For instance, there were fingerprints, palm prints, and footprints found at the crime scene that did not match marks, suggesting the possibility of another perpetrator. Additionally, Christine and Amber both had DNA from unidentified males under their fingernails, indicating that they may have fought off an attacker. The presence of these defensive wounds and DNA raised new questions. If Mark wasn't the killer, then who was? The defense began to develop an alternative theory suggesting that Christine's brother, Glenn, could have been involved. Glenn was the one who had discovered the bodies, and during the initial investigation, he had told the police that Amber had gaping head injuries. The defense argued that the only way Glenn could have known this detail was if he had been present when the murders occurred, which I don't really understand because you can just look at a head and see if there's a gaping wound. You wouldn't have to be present when it's occurring to know that it's there. But there were also concerns about Glenn's behavior at the crime scene. When police arrived, they noticed that Glenn had a fresh scratch on his nose. And while Glenn initially dismissed it as being from a cat, he later admitted that he had a habit of picking at scabs. And this, combined with blood evidence found in Glenn's car and home that was a partial match to Christine and Amber, raised more red flags. But why would Glenn want to kill his sister and his niece? The defense proposed a disturbing possibility that Glenn had been harming Amber and Christine had found out, leading to a confrontation that ended in murder. Now, this theory is shocking, and there is no solid evidence to back it up, and the prosecution dismissed it as a baseless speculation, which honestly, it does seem far-fetched in my opinion too. You'll have to tell me what you think. But in 2013, after years of legal battles and mounting doubts about the original conviction, Mark's defense team successfully argued for a retrial. The Judicial Privy Council, which is the final court of appeal in New Zealand at the time, agreed that significant questions remained about the forensic evidence, particularly the validity of the brain matter testing. And Mark was released on bail for 18 months while he awaited his new trial, a decision that brought relief to his family and supporters, many of whom had maintained his innocence from the start. But I can only imagine that some people were like, I don't know, shocked and appalled that he was let out during this time. The second trial began in 2015, and this time the prosecution changed its approach. They argued that the murders had occurred not only in the early evening, as previously thought, but in the early hours of August 30th, after the sex worker had left Mark's hotel. This shift in the timeline meant that the prosecution no longer needed to rely on the theory that Mark had tampered with Christine's computer to cover up the timeline of the crime. However, the defense was ready to attack the credibility of the forensic evidence once again. They brought forward multiple experts who testified that the stains on Mark's shirt could not be conclusively identified as brain matter, and that the testing method used by Dr. Miller was fundamentally flawed. Dr. Miller himself testified via video, admitting that his lab wasn't equipped to handle forensic testing and that the IHC method was not typically used for this kind of analysis. Despite the defense's efforts to cast doubt on the evidence, the jury once again found Mark Lundy guilty of the murders of his wife and daughter. This second conviction seemed to finally close the chapter on one of New Zealand's most notorious murder cases, but questions still lingered. The police and prosecution remained firm in their belief that they had convicted the right man, pointing to the forensic evidence, the timeline, and the financial motive as key components of the case. Mark's supporters, however, continued to argue that the police had ignored crucial evidence and that the real killer was still out there. Mark was returned to prison to serve out his life sentence, with his next opportunity for parole set for 2022. As the years passed, the case remained a topic of fierce debate. While some believed that justice had been served, others were convinced that Mark had been wrongfully convicted. Now, the central question of the case remains: could Mark Lundy have killed his wife and daughter in such a brutal fashion, driven by financial desperation, or had the police failed to explore other leads and suspects? By 2022, Mark Lundy had spent over two decades in prison for the murders of his wife and daughter. And despite his two convictions, the debate over his guilt persisted, with many supporters continuing to advocate for his innocence. Mark's first chance at parole arrived in August of 2022, but it was far from a hopeful moment for him. The parole board expressed concerns that Mark had not taken any meaningful steps to address potential triggers that could lead him to reoffend. This was a common condition for parole consideration, acknowledging one's crime, reflecting on the motive, and presenting a plan to avoid a similar situation in the future. But there was a catch. Mark had maintained his innocence throughout both trials and the years following. He insisted there was nothing to address because he hadn't committed the crime in the first place. And this posed a significant dilemma. If Mark was indeed guilty, his refusal to admit his role in the murders showed a lack of remorse, which made the parole board reluctant to release him. But on the other hand, if Mark was innocent, as he claimed, then the very framework of the parole process was just setting him up for failure, demanding that he provide explanations and take responsibility for something he claims he never did. Now, ultimately, the board denied Mark's request for parole, citing his lack of a safety plan and unresolved issues surrounding his alcohol consumption. They noted that Mark's drinking had been a problem in the past, and without addressing it, they weren't comfortable with releasing him back into society. Mark's next chance for parole would come the following year in 2023. Now, in May of 2023, Mark Lundy once again appeared before the parole board, hoping for a different outcome. This time, he had begun attending treatment programs to address his drinking, but the board still found significant problems with his case. Mark remained adamant that he hadn't killed Christine and Amber, which meant he couldn't offer any insights into his supposed motives or actions. And for the parole board, this was obviously a major issue. Without any reflection on the crime, Mark couldn't provide a compelling argument for why he should be released and why he wouldn't be a threat to society. The board also continued to express concerns about his alcohol issues, even though Mark had taken steps to begin addressing them. But the larger issue remained his insistence on his innocence. As with the previous hearing, the board's decision hinged on the same problem. How could Mark prove he was rehabilitated if he maintained he had never done anything wrong in the first place? So once again, Mark was denied parole, leaving him to continue serving his life sentence. His next opportunity for parole would come in the years ahead, but it was unclear if anything would change unless Mark's stance on the crime did. While Mark's conviction remained intact, the doubts surrounding his guilt persisted, with some continuing to question whether the police had ignored other potential suspects. One theory that gained traction in certain circles was that the real perpetrator might have been someone close to Mark, perhaps even his brother-in-law, Glenn. The defense had raised the possibility during the second trial, pointing out that Glenn had been the one to discover the bodies and had suspiciously detailed knowledge of Amber's head injuries when he called emergency services. Additionally, the fresh scratch on Glenn's nose and the presence of blood in his car and home led some to wonder if he might have been involved in the murders. Glenn's behavior at the crime scene also raised eyebrows, especially when the police found traces of blood that were a close match to Christine and Amber in both his home and his vehicle. The defense team pointed to this as potential evidence of Glenn's involvement, but it wasn't enough to sway the jury. Glenn had an explanation for everything. The scratch on his nose was from a cat, and the blood traces were dismissed as inconclusive. Nevertheless, some supporters of Mark continued to believe that Glenn had more to answer for. They also pointed to his behavior after the murders, noting that he seemed evasive and overly emotional, which they interpreted as signs of guilt. But despite these suspicions, Glenn was never seriously pursued as a suspect, and the police remained focused on Mark as their sole perpetrator. Another theory that circulated in the years following the trial revolved around Mark's struggling business ventures and the financial strain that he was under. In the months leading up to the murders, Mark's debts had grown larger, particularly after his investment in the vineyard failed to pay off. Some believed that Mark's financial desperation was the key to understanding the motive behind the crime, but others thought there might be an even more sinister explanation. On the day of the murders, Mark received a phone call from one of his business partners who warned him that a creditor had been making threatening calls. This creditor had apparently said something ominous about Mark's life, suggesting that he should be on the lookout. Now, this led some to speculate that the murders might have been an attempt to send a message to Mark, possibly a case of mistaken identity or an attempt to intimidate him. And while this theory had some traction, the police ultimately ruled it out after investigating the person who made the call. The individual was interviewed and offered immunity in exchange for admitting involvement in the murders, but they denied any connection to Christine and Amber's deaths. The case also had its share of other unexplored leads, with some pointing to individuals in Christine's life who may have had a motive to harm her. One such individual was a former coworker of Christine's who reportedly had a contentious relationship with her. And this person also had a violent past, leading some to wonder if they might have had a hand in the killings. However, when the police approached this former coworker, they refused to provide their DNA, a fact that only added fuel to the speculation. While refusing to provide DNA isn't inherently suspicious, it was enough for some to consider this individual as a possible suspect, though the police never pursued the lead aggressively. These lingering questions and unexplored leads have kept the case alive in the minds of many, even as Mark continues to serve his life sentence. With the defense team's efforts exhausted and Mark's repeated denials of guilt, the case remains one of New Zealand's most debated mysteries. More than two decades after the murders of Christine and Amber Lundy, the case continues to captivate the public. For some, it's a straightforward story of a man driven to desperate measures by financial ruin. For others, it's a tale of a miscarriage of justice with an innocent man wrongfully imprisoned while the real killer walks free. Mark Lundy remains behind bars with his next parole hearing years away. Whether or not he will ever be released is uncertain given his steadfast refusal to admit to the murders. For the parole board, this remains a sticking point. Without an acknowledgement of guilt, they are unlikely to ever feel confident in his rehabilitation. Now, in the end, the Lundy family murders are a tragic reminder of the dark complexities that sometimes lie beneath the surface of seemingly perfect lives. A small town like Palmerston North, with its friendly, quiet atmosphere, never expected to become the center of such a horrific crime. The brutality of the killings shocked the community to its core, and the questions surrounding the case, both about Mark's potential guilt and the possibility of other suspects, continue to haunt those who followed it. What remains, however, are the lives that were cut tragically short. Christine, who was a dedicated wife and mother, and Amber, a bright, happy 7-year-old little girl with so much promise ahead of her. Whatever the truth behind their murders may be, their loss is a tragedy that leaves a lasting mark on all those who knew them and those who have followed their story. Thank you so much for listening to Mama Mystery, and we will see you next week for a new episode. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.